Hi, I'm Mike Sundy, screenwriter and children's book author. You're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader, and hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode, oh my gosh, 15 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show on iTunes. It's an awesome podcast. You could check it out. Just look for Dan and Travis. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, which is a series of podcasts looking for the culture and pop culture. Really, just a ton of great shows to listen to over at www.chronicrift.com. Want to thank everybody for listening, downloading, retweeting, and sharing the really fantastic interview last week with Mike Sundy, just about the nuts and bolts of screenwriting and the Austin Film Festival. We're coming up on it. We're really excited. So thanks for listening and sharing, and feel free to keep sharing. Very proud to welcome a very distinguished and experienced guest here to the HTD Express, Mr. Ron Greenfield, originally from New York City. Spent much of his career as a film graphic artist, directing, designing, and producing trailers for films you may have heard of, such as Arthur, Reds, Escape from Alcatraz, Star Trek, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. He then was a pioneer in the home video entertainment world because he joined CBS Fox's home video campaigns back when there really wasn't, back when home video was just in its infancy. And he worked on the campaigns for Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. So if you were a kid like me at the time, you can blame Ron for helping get you so excited you couldn't stand it to see those movies. He also worked as a senior director of creative services for the legendary Republic Pictures, Hallmark Hall of Fame home entertainment series, working on the popular series Beauty and the Beast. He also worked for one of the most legendary moguls in all of Hollywood, Mr. Aaron Spelling. He was the vice president of marketing and creative services for Mr. Spelling. He was a creative chief marketing officer for Software Magic, working for companies Electronic Arts, Atari, LucasArts. My goodness. And today, he's still at it. He's an author of two fantastic books, A Sneak Peek Behind the Curtain and Perspectives of Entertainment, and he's launched a really, really amazing new website that everybody in the entertainment business needs to check out, whether you're a seasoned vet or you're just starting out in the business. Everyone should check out and explore www.aspectsofentertainment.com. It is a real privilege and pleasure for me to welcome to the show Mr. Ron Greenfield. Ron, how are you today?
I'm doing really good. How are you, Tim?
Doing good.
Really good.
That's a heck of a resume you've got.
Thank you.
One of the things I'd really love to talk to you about, because it's so interesting, you are a super creative person, you're a graphic designer, you're a proper artist, but you also spent much of your career, as we just talked about, very much involved in the commerce of Hollywood, in promotion, in selling, in home video campaigns. Hollywood is very much sort of a frictious relationship between commerce and creativity. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about how those two things not only coexist and sometimes are in conflict, but actually can thrive together.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I would say the beginning part of my career was, yeah, I was a graphic artist that got into the entertainment business.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into marketing when I got to CBS Fox. I think a lot of people don't realize that the entertainment business, and you're talking films, you're even talking the theater, gaming, opera, whatever area of the industry we're talking about, it's always going to be in some kind of combination of the art that is involved and the commerce that's involved. I mean, it brings together the both things, you know. It's probably if you think about entertainment in the largest sense, and again, it's film, theater, gaming, it's a very creative field, more so than any other I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you're there to make money. You know, it's not like you're just painting a picture and, gee, I want to put it up on the wall. You're making a film. You're producing a musical. You're producing a game. Ultimately, it has to make money. And also, it's not just like, people think, oh, well, it's filling the bank accounts of certain people. Yeah, well, that's part of it. The other thing is, if any venture is successful, money is put aside to develop other projects. I mean, without development, there's nothing else. I mean, you know, you're just going to try and take one shot in the dark to another shot in the dark. but then you'll have the money to develop other projects. Also, if you think about it too, and right now, okay, just for our purpose, we can think about the studio system.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's been my experience based on my years at Spelling, Software Magic. If there's a property that comes into the studio, the thinking is it's not just going to be along the lines of, oh, this would make a great film. But they're going to take that property and see where it could be leveraged throughout so many divisions of that studio. All right. All you have to think about is the Star Wars franchise. Think about Harry Potter franchise. Think about Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. Look how many different areas that is all franchised across. You know, sure. You have the movies. It wouldn't surprise me at some point somebody's going to think about a musical of Pirates of the Caribbean. It wouldn't surprise me.
Sure.
Games, clothing. I mean, Harry Potter, I mean, you know, there's in Orlando, there's the whole Harry Potter experience. So, you know, yeah, it's a business. You have to make money. But at the same time, it's a very creative business. You know, it's not, you're not balancing books.
Right.
All right. You're not balancing books and make sure your debits and your credits are equaling out. Although sometimes in Hollywood it's been known to be creative bookkeeping, but that's a whole other story. But it is, but it is a business. You know, people forget about it sometimes. There's a reason why it's called show business or entertainment industry. It has to turn a profit. I mean, even if you go back to the golden age of Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, they had these great stars and they had these great properties. At the same time, they couldn't afford it if the movies were not making any money.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to make money in order to continue. And it's like what I was saying at the beginning of our conversation. You know, you use that money or that profit, some part of it, some percentage of it, to develop the next thing.
I think there's also a misconception that a lot of the people who are sort of in charge of the money are not themselves creative people. They may not be writers or directors or an artist, but you mentioned Aaron Spelling, a very shrewd businessman, but also a very creative person as well.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's going to be like in any industry. You're going to have people who, quote, are not creative handling the money. And you're going to have some who are, they get it. You're going to have some who are, who don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's just, it's dollars and cents on a ledger. I mean, at one of the places I work, the chief financial officer always was coming to my office with these, like, I have this great idea. I have this really great idea. And I mean, it really sucked. I mean, it wouldn't fly. And after a while, you know, I got kind of like retarded. And I said, you know what? And he came to me with this one idea, and I just knew it wasn't going to fly. And I had to think, well, from a creative standpoint, he wouldn't get it. So I broke it down for him in dollars and cents.
Mm.
And once he got that, he said, okay, I see what you're saying, Ron. But he still continued doing it. And I finally said to them, okay, you can create the campaigns, David. All right, I get to balance the books. Well, then it stopped.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I said, okay, I'll balance the books. And I'm not the greatest mathematician, so you got the point.
Yeah, one of the best line producers I ever worked with even said she was terrible at creativity. She couldn't think of a story. She couldn't do any of that, but she loved being around it. She was great with numbers, great with budgets and things, and loved being like near, like all of us, like the editors and all of us who were working at it. But she fully admitted she couldn't do it herself. And I thought, you know, you're all right.
You know, it brings up another point too, Tim, and that is, because, you know, it's not like you're going to be in a think tank with just creative people. You're going to be in a think tank with a whole, you're going to be in an atmosphere or an environment with a whole lot of people. A lot of them won't be creative. Some are going to be in positions of power. And they say, well, you know, I'd like, and it happened to me a few times, where they'll say, well, you know, I think this should be a different color, or I think this should have a different picture here. The question then becomes for the creative person, which battle do you pick to fight? You know, and I had to make that decision on many occasions, and it came down to, okay, with whatever the suggestion is, will it ultimately affect the integrity of the project? In my case, it had to be marketing and the design of a poster or anything. If it really wasn't going to affect the integrity of the project, yeah, let it go. It's not worth the energy or the time to fight about it. However, there were on some occasions where I felt the film that we were going to distribute, the quality of it and a lot of other things, would really put a black mark against the studio. And I went to the, you know, those were the fights I went to the mat for. Some I won, some I lost. But, you know, it was at that point I said, you know what, guys, this is really going to affect our positioning in the industry. I mean, this is a really awful film and it should not be produced and it should not be distributed. So like I said, I would say, think about which battles you want to fight.
I think that's one of the great lessons of the business, and I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, because I've seen people fight the wrong battles, and when you lose a lot, you know. Sometimes you could lose your job, sometimes, whereas, it, as you just described in your thing, sometimes you win those battles, sometimes you lose those battles, but if you're picking the right one, your integrity is going to be intact. I think we hear about these uncompromising filmmakers, people like Aronofsky and David Lynch, who I think are just brilliant and wonderful. But look, there are certain battles there, even those guys are picking, you know, just to get through the day and just to get things, because not everything goes your way.
No, it doesn't. And you also have to, you know, think about, too, in the whole mix of all the people you work with, you're going to have some who are going to be at the top of their game. You're going to have people who just like, this is my job and I'm just doing it to get my paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to have some people who really don't give a shit.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. And I'd rather put it this way. The people who really don't care, you know, they'll just do it to get by. But the people who do it and who are clueless, to me, that's more dangerous, or that's more anti-creative, because they can make a mess of things, and it's happened to me, too, where there were people employed who were part of the process, who really were clueless as to what they were doing, how they got to their position. That's a whole other thing. But anyway, here you are in this situation. They don't know what you're doing, so you're the one who has to pick up the slack. Yeah. And it's a double, you know, it's just a lot more headaches. And you're trying to counter that because you're undoing the mistake this person made. And then trying to correct it. And when you get into the field of talent, and let's say well-known celebrities, actors, actresses, that can even be, you're really walking on thin ice there, because it can go any which way. And if a person is really not cognizant of that, yeah, it can make for a lot of problems.
The one of the things I've had in my personal experience, and I'd love to throw this at you, is like sometimes working for people who are money-driven doesn't really bother me. Sometimes working for people who aren't super creative doesn't bother me. I like working for people who are tough but fair. I like working for people who are very confident. The worst experiences I've had, Ron, have been when people are so terrified of being fired that they're almost petrified to inaction. And that I've found the hardest way to, because then everybody underneath them is then sort of petrified to an action of like, well, what do we do? Because yeah. the boss is scared he's going to get fired, which, look, it's that kind of business. I hate to say it, but I don't think you have to sort of embrace the fact that you may be fired in the entertainment industry and may have to find a new job at another studio, another network, another show.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to be glib about it, but all I can say is, you know, you got to put yourself out there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You can't sit or stand in a corner and just cower. You know, for myself, you know, anybody really, and I don't care what you do. You can be an actor, an actress. You can be a DP. Whatever your profession is. I can speak for myself. Very quickly, if you have any reasonable intelligence, all right, you can separate the wheat from the chaff right away. I mean, you're sort of picking out, okay, this is a person who gets things done. This is a person who really knows their stuff. This is a person who really is, like, pushing the envelope, all right, and they're trying to, like, bust through. I mean, they're trying to make this thing happen. Those were the people I was always attracted to. And that's, you know, so, you know, I wasn't like the one, well, I don't know what you do, you know, I can do this, you know, screw them. You know, no, I was never aligned with that. You know, it was just, you know, personality wise, I could not sync up with that type of person. So I always went for the very aggressive type. I mean, the people who I work for or who are really creative, those were the people who I sort of like attached to or I sort of emulated because they got it done and they weren't afraid to make mistakes. I got it. I mean, newsflash for anybody here who's starting their career. If you don't think you're going to make mistakes, this may be not be the right business for you because you're going to make mistakes. The good thing is that you learn from them. I mean, if you make mistakes and you don't, all right, then you have a serious problem. But at the same time, I've made my share of mistakes. The thing was, is, okay, I learned from it. All right, Ron's not going there again. Because that's how you build the foundation of your career. Because with the mistakes, it may sound cliched, but it is a stepping stone for you. I mean, you learn, if you're working for a DP on a film set and you give him the wrong lens, okay, you're not going to make that mistake again.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you hand the guy the wrong lens, you're going to not, you know, one, you may be fired, but you are definitely not going to make that mistake again. Then, on the other hand, too, it really depends on the personality of the person involved. If you are very happy in your niche, that's very cool. If that's what you like doing and you don't want to move from that, that's fine. I was just never that kind of person. You know what? Because as I started out, I started to learn about film editing. All right, this is how music comes in, and this is how your script comes in. And so, yeah, I started out as a graphic designer, and then all of a sudden, I'm involved with all this other thing, all this other stuff. And it's like, wow, this is really cool. And I've said this before when I got into home entertainment. Okay, I had a foundation, but that was such a nascent industry. We didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we had our foundation, whatever you did was in sales or in marketing or in design. But this opened up a whole new ballpark and, you know, there we were, and like, we're figuring out the rules as we're going along here, and talk about mistakes. But at the same time, it pushed me into territories I never even fathomed 4 or 5 years before that.
See, I love what you're saying, and I just want to highlight something in regards to just screenwriting for a second for the screenwriters out there listening. Is that one of the biggest mistakes I hear from writers is like a fear of sometimes making a mistake or writing the wrong sentence or writing the wrong scene. Don't worry about it. Those are the best mistakes to make as a writer. write the scene down. If it's the wrong scene, you can rewrite it. You can re-explore it. Maybe that scene belongs later in the piece. But to be afraid of writing the wrong thing petrifies you and terrifies you into, again, inaction. And that's never going to get your script done. That's never going to get your screenwriting done. And that's something that is true in all aspects of the entertainment business.
Well, you know, that's so true. Writing is not my first calling, but in the last few years, especially with the launch of Aspects of Entertainment, I have to write a lot. I write the blogs and everything. Mm-hmm. And so I used to be very envious of copywriters. At the same time, copywriters are very envious of art directors and creative directors because they have that visual sense.
Mm.
And in the old days, even now, in most of the big advertising agencies, they would pair a copywriter with an art director because they could each play off one another.
Mm.
And so, which was very good because, you know, sometimes the art director would think of the line and the copywriter would think of the image.
Mm.
You know, so it was role reversal.
Yeah.
First of all, you never know where your inspiration is going to come from. You could be cooking dinner, all of a sudden the idea comes to you. Seriously.
I love it, yeah.
When I started to write, I got so anal, you know, like, well, that word doesn't sound right next to this one. And finally I just said, Ron, write the fucking thing.
Yeah.
Just write it, you know? And because I was trying to keep it in a length of, let's say, 500 to 600 words. And finally I said, the first time out, don't edit yourself. Just put it down. And like I said, I am not a writer by profession. At the same time, what I've done, and it seems to be working for me, is I'll just write it, leave it. I mean, literally, leave it for maybe a few hours or look at it the next day. And you come back with a fresh eye and said, okay, this is not working, you know?
Yep.
And so, I mean, I constantly work at this because, like I said, it's not my first calling.
And I love that you mentioned the idea comes to you during dinner. I mean, there's so many countless ideas of that. I mean, so many writers talk about that. The shower is a magic place.
Yes.
With ideas. And that's one of the things about writing every day that people talk about is because some days you will write 3 pages, some days you'll write 20. But if you're writing every day, it's there in your subconscious. You know, it's right there under that layer. I was wondering if we could talk about trailers a little bit, because sure. I think that's a really fascinating art that sometimes doesn't get talked about enough. And it's possibly one of the most important aspects of a movie. I mean, even nowadays, as the movie theater experience is changing, trailers online are a big deal. You know, on iTunes and Apple and YouTube, watching trailers and social media is still a big experience. And it is, in many ways, the movie's first impression onto the world.
That's true.
What?
And, you know, first of all, you know, obviously the movies or the studios, they got to get people into the theaters. So, you know, mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm not the only one who is experiencing this, but when you go to see a movie, about a half an hour is trailers.
Yep.
And you're sort of like a little inundated, and it's like a little overkill, you know? And especially if it's one effects movie after the other, all of a sudden they're like just melding in your mind, you know? Like, what's the difference? And last summer, I went to the movies to see something, and there were about 4 or 5 of heavy-driven effects movies, all right? Most of them bombed, by the way. But it was like, boom, car crash, boom, another kind of crash, explosion, main character walks out of the explosion. And I'm counting like 3 or 4 different movies. I'm like, okay, what's the difference? Because in my mind, they sort of just gelled together.
Hmm.
All right. You're absolutely right. A trailer is your first impression of what the film is. So basically, in 2.5 minutes, if not less, you have to convey the best things about that movie. All right? It doesn't have to be linear, and it doesn't have to be literal. But you should have the wow moment where in the minds of the audience, they come away with, you know what? I want to see that movie.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And like I said, it doesn't have to be linear. A lot of the trailers I did were not linear. All right. If it was a musical, you sort of focused on the big elaborateness of it, or, you know, the musical numbers. If it was sci-fi or horror, you focused on those elements that's going to scare the shit out of somebody. You know, because there are built-in audiences for that. And then in the process of producing the trailer, at least for me, it was, you get to, it was, it's like working on a mini movie almost. Because then you get to see, and like it was the learning experience for me. All right, this is how the sound will work with it, and this is how the copy will work for it, and right. This is the visuals you use. And sometimes it's graphics. Will the graphics better serve the trailer as opposed to this clip? Because sometimes the movies really sucked, and so there wasn't that much to pull from. You know, that like, that would entice you. And you also bring up another thing, because one, trailers are an art. They are your first exposure to the public of what the movie is about. And there's a very interesting case in point happening right now, which has already produced a lot of flack online, and it was blatantly apparent to me, and maybe because my eye is, and, you know, because I'm so involved in it and I've done it so many times. Over the summer, Disney released the trailer or a teaser. It's really not a full-length trailer for Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw it online, and I'm looking at it and I said, well, that's kind of weird. There's no songs.
Right.
I mean, it's Sondheim. It's Sondheim. You know, one of the most prolific composers in the last 100 years or so. Okay, so last week I go to the movies to see Gone Girl, which, a little sidebar, people should go see it. It's really excellent. And again, there's the trailer for Into the Woods, and I notice there are no songs in here. All right, I said, something's really weird here. And as I investigated, you know, as I looked into it, there's been this whole online thing because there have been massive cuts to this movie, and a lot of the score or the music has been eliminated. And maybe Disney was not the right studio to produce this because, quote, it's Disney Family Entertainment. And if you know anything about the musical Into the Woods, there's a lot of sexual innuendos and overtones. Well, that's not family entertainment with Mickey, you know, Mickey and Minnie there.
Yeah.
So, you know, so from a marketing standpoint, it's going to be very interesting how up until Christmas Day when it's released, how they're going to position this movie, because if they really ravaged the movie and, you know, there could be a big backlash from, let's say, from like Sondheim fans or people who appreciate or like the musical movie genre. But that was a very obvious marketing point on Disney's behalf to downplay the music and come up with the visuals and Meryl Streep, you know, because she's the main star of that. Other times I can go back and I can tell you there were trailers that were much better than the movie.
I could think of several.
I can think of several. And we've all been pulled in. You know, like you go and you see the trailer and you think, wow, that movie is going to be great. And then you go and it's a real piece of crap. And you realize the best scenes were pulled from the movie and put into the trailer. And that's what made the trailer. Because the worst thing you can do, and you have to think about a trailer as you would of any other piece of marketing or advertising, and that is, it represents the movie. If you piss off your audience, that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
Because it's very hard. You know, if you piss off the movie, if you piss off your audience, and you're telling them, this movie is something it really isn't, you lost that confidence. You also lost that dollar. So, you know, if you want to come back to the beginning of our conversation, Tim, you've lost money going into the bank, so to speak.
There's a great example of that, and it's, I don't want to sound super negative about another filmmaker, because Spike Jonze made a fantastic movie called Her, and I'm a big fan of Spike Jonze, but a perfect example of that was a movie a few years ago called Where the Wild Things Are, which was very much pitched and promoted and marketed as a very fun, loving, cute kids movie, and it is not. It is a deep, dark exploration of human misery and the dysfunction of a human family. And I literally, I remember during the last 20 minutes, I said to Megan, I was like, I might have to leave. I don't think I can take much more of this abuse. And I was wholly unprepared for the dark journey that that movie was taking me on. And that, and I don't think that movie was particularly successful. I don't think I'm the only person saying that. My apologies to Spike Jonze, who's a brilliant filmmaker, but that movie really was like almost felt like baseball bats. But the marketing was all filled with fun songs and cute creatures and everybody around. I thought, oh, this would be like a live-action Pixar movie.
Yeah, you know what? The last thing you ever want to do is piss off your audience. I mean, because, and also because you also have a built-in fan base. And, you know, you can name any director, and there's a certain expectation you have when you go see their films. All right. Not to say you shouldn't experiment, but if the film is being positioned and advertised as this, as let's say A, but you're really delivering B and C,
right?
Not a good thing.
Right.
And not that I've done it, but from the other, you know, going back to earlier in the conversation, you know, when I say, there are those projects that you go to the mat for because you think, you know, don't release this movie. It's so bad. And I'm thinking of one. And this was a movie that should have never been made in the first place. No big stars or anything. Nobody would ever know. Two, it should have never been made into a film. And three, even the fact that it was made into a film should have never seen the light of distribution. And I remember at the studio, I said, this is one of the things I went to the mat for. And I said, do not release this movie. It is so bad. It's going to put a black mark on our name. It's going to really impact everybody negatively. And the thing was, oh, but we need to put something in the pipeline. I said, okay, I get that. But this is not the one to put in the pipeline. And sure enough, it was for home video distribution. The backlash was terrible, and the next time the studio had another movie where we were in a certain situation, basically the distributors came back and said, fuck you, we took a bath on the last one,
yeah.
We're not taking another bath on this one. So, yeah, it can come back and bite you. And, you know, so whatever it is, make sure you're knowing your audience and who you're pitching to.
Absolutely right. One last thing about trailers, though, it's just, and not so much a question, more a comment, like, something that happens with us screenwriters, it's a common complaint, is that, well, your script, and I talked about this with Mike on the last interview, was like, your script better be pretty great in the first 10 pages, because people may not read past that. And we're now actually in an era where your script better be great in the first 1 to 5 pages, because people may not read past that. And there's a lot of complaint of like, well, how do I create that experience? How do I create a great experience in 1 to 5 pages? And in many ways, that's the art, because I'm thinking of another film that a science fiction film that came out a few years ago that was very widely, very heralded as a great new thing, and it turned out not to be. People could probably do the math and figure out which one it was. The trailer was one of the greatest movie experiences of the year for me. And it was like, oh my, I mean, it can be done, and trailers are a perfect example of how to create that experience within 2.5-3 minutes, you know, tops.
Yeah, you can. I mean, and that's really the talent and the creativity of the individual. Whether you're a writer or you're doing trailers and things like that, at some point, let's say if you're a writer and somebody's going to read your script, you're going to have that wow moment within the first three pages.
Mm-hmm.
In the trailer, you're going to have something up there that visually you go, holy shit, that's incredible. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I just want to...
You know, you really do something that's, you know, because the way some trailers are cut now, it's just like...
Bam, bam, bam. Boom.
Yeah. And like, okay, yeah, I get it, you know, and let's... All right, let's go on to the next one.
And I'd like to throw this one at you, Ron, if I may.
Sure.
I think when you say wow moment, I think sometimes we make the mistake of thinking, us screenwriters make the mistake of thinking, oh my God, I have to knock somebody's head off. Oh my God, I have to blow up the Empire State Building. A wow moment can actually be like a really good joke.
Yeah.
A wow moment, it doesn't have to necessarily be, oh my God, the planet Earth is blowing up, but just sometimes like I remember one of those, a wow moment in the Ocean's 11 trailer was George Clooney and Brad Pitt and Matt Damon trying to figure out how to work the daggum bomb. Just because it was so funny, and you're like, oh, I'm with those guys. I want to see those two goofs rob a casino. Sometimes that wow moment is just that one sort of thing. Like, I almost call it the TV guideline. What is that thing that's going to define your movie in one or two words or sentences?
Exactly. And in fact, anybody, especially writers, know this too. When you go into a pitch meeting, all right, and you don't have 5 minutes to go into a whole dissertation about your script. You have two sentences to say, this is what it's about, and people get it right away. I mean, mm-hmm. It has to be that pithy and that, like, right spot on. Two sentences, this is what it's about. And if you could relate it to something, and I don't have an example right now, but if you're talking about a sci-fi movie and you happen to say Star Trek meets Gremlins or whatever, it's like that. This way, the person in their mind associates the two, they get it, and... You know what? You can go to the next level. But if you're there sitting 5 minutes and you're explaining, and then they open the door, and then they, get it. It's not going to happen.
And there's an element to that I think we forget. If I could riff off that for a second. And I don't want to say this in a way that sounds demeaning toward the audience, because I'm not. But the audience, your movie-going audience is hardworking, 40, 50 hours a week, dealing with kids, families, mortgages, bills. They want to go to the movies, put their feet up, and relax for two and a half hours. Whatever the genre, comedy. Gone Girl, for example, was packed. They're just doing full houses everywhere, Gone Girl. And that's a very intense movie.
Yeah, and it's a long movie.
It's a long movie. And it's not that you have to dumb it down, but it has to be accessible to people. People have to be able to look at the movie and understand it in a way. And I think sometimes we make the mistake of thinking, well, I don't want to dumb it down. I want it to be this. Look, you can even dumb down some of the Paul Thomas Anderson movies and Wes Anderson and some of these guys who make these very highbrow comedies. Even some of their films can be like, oh, I get it, in a two-minute trailer. I know exactly what they're trying to do. Exotic Marigold Hotel is a great example of a movie that's very highbrow, very sophisticated, very intelligent, and in one sentence, you could sum it up. And in the trailer, when you watch the trailer, you know exactly what the movie is, and we'll decide whether or not you want to see it based on that.
Okay, now you bring up an interesting aspect, too, about the trailers, too. When, to go to the movies for a family is a very expensive proposition.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? You know, if you think about babysitters, so you're taking the kids, and it's the parking, and then, of course, it's the admission and the popcorn, whatever. That's one thing. But people also forget that audiences like to discover their favorites. You know what I'm saying?
Hmm.
And two come to mind right off the bat. You know, when I went to see Gone Girl, Rosamund Kind, I think her name is.
Rosamund Pike.
I was not familiar with her. And I'm thinking, wow, this is an incredible performance.
Mm.
This was really a finely nuanced performance. And I also happen to like Ben Affleck. You know, I think he's really quite talented, especially, not just as an actor, as a director. He's, you know, Argo.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful movies.
you know, if he continues on that trajectory, he's going to have quite a stellar career. But I really do like him because she held her own with him. What, about a year and a half ago, I had not seen The Hunger Games because that's not a genre I particularly am attracted to. So I saw Jennifer Lawrence in Silver Linings Playbook. And I'm watching her and I'm saying, holy shit, who is she?
Right.
And I'm thinking, she's holding her own with De Niro in a scene. She got some major chops here. I mean, she got, she had it down. And I'm thinking, she can hold it with De Niro. You know, that's quite good.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, you know, people like to discover their own stars, too. And that's part of the whole film-going audience, theater-going audience, too. You know, there are actors and actresses I've seen over the years in stage productions who had the supporting role, but they made such an impression because they have that something extra.
Mm.
And I don't care who says it, that's something extra. It can't be defined. It's just there or it isn't. You know, and it's on, I've seen it on the stage and I've seen it in film.
That's a good segue to a topic I know you wanted to touch upon, which is there's sometimes Hollywood tries to duplicate. Well, I don't think they even try to duplicate so much, but they try to capitalize on previous things with remakes and reboots and stuff like that, some of which are successful, but a lot of which are not. And I know that it's very hard to replicate the magic of something the second time around.
In a word, you really can't.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't. And this is, you know, sometimes the story may be applicable for a new generation. You know, the only one that comes to mind, but it changed. The basic premise of the story was there, and it was sort of readapted for a different generation. If you think about the movie A Star Is Born, mm-hmm. All right. The first one was with Janet Gaynor in the 30s. Then it was remade into, it was musicalized with George Cukor and Judy Garland and James Mason in the early 50s. And then it was redone again with Streisand and Chris Christopherson, but it was taken out of the film and it was placed in the world of rock and roll or rock music. And so that, I could get it. And also, in each way, you had somebody dynamic. But then again, what if somebody ever tried to do a remake of Casablanca? It's not going to happen because it can't be done. How are you going to duplicate the chemistry between Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart? Okay, what and it's true of television too. At a certain point in time, these creative forces come together to create magic. Period. It can't be explained. It can't be defined. It's one of those things that you cherish for all time because it's so incredible. All right. If you think about the musical 1951, I think it was, An American in Paris. All right. At the very end, set to the music of Gershwin, Gene Kelly, and Leslie Caron, dancing on that incredible set with the Impressionist paintings. That's never going to happen again. You can't duplicate that again. And, you know, over the years, like recently there was a remake of Rosemary's Baby. There was a remake of Psycho. There was a remake of Arthur. They all tanked because all the right forces, the best way I can say it is, came together at one point in time to create something really quite unique. All right?
Yeah.
And I say that because I worked on Arthur, the original movie. And so when I heard there was going to be a remake, I mean, the first thought, and with who, I thought, oh, this is going to tank. And sure enough, it did. I mean, you know, you just couldn't.
One of my favorite examples of that, I think you say that really well, the creative forces line up. And that's what we're all trying to do. I mean, we're all trying to be one of those creative forces lining up to make magic, and hopefully we will. Us aspiring screenwriters and what have you is like, one of my favorite, Bill Moyers said this about Star Wars. If Star Wars comes out in the 1960s, it's Buck Rogers. If Star Wars comes out in the 1990s, it's Goofy and laughed out of theater. But in the post-Watergate, post-Vietnam era, at a time when the whole country needed a hero, needed that good old-fashioned, I'm going out to get the bad guy hero, it was the absolute perfect time, and it ended up changing the culture. And I think...
Absolutely. I would agree with that, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of writing and such like that, though, I definitely want to make some time. Let's talk about why you picked up some of this writing, why you put pen to paper, and let's talk about some of the books that you've written.
All right. Well, you know, I didn't plan on being a writer. It was more out of necessity than anything else. One of the things when I started Aspects of Entertainment was because my whole career has been based on realizing the vision of somebody else. You know, this was your film, this was your production, whatever. All right. And because of my talent and my vision, I could put it out there. I figured at this point in my career and life, I wanted to say what I wanted to say, all right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is the best way I know how to do it. And if you like it, that's terrific. If you don't like it, that's fine too, all right? But Ron's going to have his say because this is how I say it. And one of the things I have to watch out for in myself is I don't want to sound like I'm teaching you. It's like almost like this interview, Tim. It's like we're having a conversation, and this is how I see it. And that's when I write something or I write a blog, that's what I try and focus on. And hopefully my passion comes through about it. I mean, I'm a big, you know, like I was talking before, the people who are most accomplished, those were the ones I was always drawn to. The people who were about passion and the passion for what they did, I was always drawn to it. I mean, you know, that's pretty much a no-brainer. I mean, are you going to be drawn to somebody who's sort of like a lump on a log and they don't really give a shit? Or are you going to, or are you going to be attracted to somebody or be aligned with somebody who like, gee, I love this. I mean, this is like terrific. You know, oh, let's go out and make this movie and I think we can get this and this. Whatever it is, you want somebody who's like there with their whole self, willing to give 150 and 200%. You know, if somebody's going to say, well, you know, I don't want to do it, you know, screw them. You know, I'm not there. You know, get it. And so what happened is, when I started the website, and it's like anything creative, if you're really starting to get into it and build the momentum, that's how the book Perspectives on Entertainment came along, because I'm thinking, well, you know, I wanted people, not necessarily accomplished professionals, but people who are just beginning their careers or thinking about it, to give them perspectives from different people about different ends of the industry that we normally don't think about. And I'm even thinking, you know, what is the next, like, Perspectives on Entertainment too? And in the book, there is even a chapter, how many people ever think about entertainment law as a career? You know, or there is a chapter on making trailers or international distribution. And in fact, somebody said to me, entertainment law? And I said, yes. I mean, that is a very crucial part of the industry, because basically the good attorneys are there to protect the intellectual property of the artist, the good ones. I'm not saying they're who's in there for the fight. I'm just saying the really good ones, they're there to protect the interest of the artist.
Yeah, every conversation I've ever had with an entertainment lawyer has been a very eye-opening experience. Very eye-opening, yeah. That's a very misunderstood aspect of the biz. I quite agree with that.
All right. I haven't, you know, because in a book, I mean, I can't have 100 chapters because, first of all, I have other things to do. But, and I wrote this, it's in Sneak Peek, which, by the way, is a free giveaway. You know, that there is no charge for that. But I talk about this too a great deal. when you go see a film, Tim, and I mean you or me or anybody, you go to the opera, you go see a stage production, you go to a show in Vegas, all right? You go to the Magic Castle or you see a show, you know, on Magic, or you go to a nightclub, doesn't matter what. How many people really consider the people who make it happen? And I'm not talking if you're a big star. I'm talking about the people making the thing happen. I'm talking about the crews on a film set. I'm talking about the crews behind stage making the musical happen. I'm talking about the people in the pit, you know, to play the music. You really don't think, because without them, it wouldn't happen.
There's a fantastic documentary. My favorite composer is Jerry Goldsmith. And I saw a great documentary on him real quick and they introduced this whole position of his lead guy within the orchestra who was translating, and they would riff back and forth about, Jerry, don't do this. I think this note is better, or that, blah, blah, blah. And I had no idea there was that whole aspect to soundtrack composing and when you're in recording and everything and how organic that was and how it wasn't just him standing up there going, okay, orchestra, play this. You know?
Yeah, I mean, you think about the people who have, if you're talking about music, the people who have to, the arranger, you know. It's just not like everybody plays together. You know, at one point you can have your percussion come in, and then at another point you can have your horns or your strings. It's a whole thing. There's a great, it's almost 50 years old now, and you can probably find it on YouTube. There's the recording session of the musical company and all the problems that happened that day in trying to record the cast album for Company with Elaine Stritch, Sondheim, the engineers. Because if you don't have a great engineer, your album is dog meat, so to speak.
Yeah.
So you really need the technician who'll know how to bring out the best in everything. All right? But in the bigger picture, you know, and we're all guilty of it, do we ever think about the people behind the scenes making it all happen?
Yeah, not enough. And it's one of the things that really bothers me, and I'm happy to say this publicly, that I'm really ashamed of, that the industry has done, is I'm very ashamed of the fact that television credits are squished so much and are almost gone through at such a snail's pace, you can barely see the names of those people. And as one who's worked on 25 plus shows, I see integral parts of the production just flash by. And it's really a shame. And it's really, really just a shame. Fortunately, we have IMDb and other ways of finding out, but there's so many names and so many people I can think of who've literally saved the day and who literally, like, one show I worked on, I said to Megan, I was like, me and so-and-so, we basically did that whole show, and our names went by like that.
Yeah,
now, it's not about, hey, patting us on the back or whatever or anything like that, but you know what I mean? Like, some little credit where credit's due is no bad thing and not an unreasonable thing to ask for.
And also, you know, too, you bring up an interesting point, because especially in my years at Spelling, because I had a lot to do with a lot of well-known people, all right? Some, I'll be honest, I'm not going to say who, were major assholes.
Sure.
All right? My teeth gritted if I had to send them a gift because they were such an asshole.
Mm.
You know, like, but I had to do it, you know, because it's part of the procedure. All right? And we're not talking, you go to Target and get something. We're talking major gifts here. But I was always very cognizant and aware of the people behind the scenes who helped me. And I would make sure they got some kind of acknowledgement too. I mean, that's something I felt I had to do, because if they didn't play their part, some things wouldn't have happened. So I remember, one quote star who was a major asshole, his assistant was terrific. She was just terrific, and she really worked with me to get certain things done. I, you know, at the end of it, And I, like I said, I had to grit my teeth. I said, okay, what does he like, you know? You know, because I just didn't want to go out and buy anything. But I also sent, you know, sent her this humongous bouquet of flowers to thank her, because she just went above and beyond, and she was just a sweetheart.
And see, I love that story, because I've worked with so many PAs who I'm like, I'm shocked you're a PA. You're going to have to be promoted soon, you know? And like, you see it, you can see talent, and you talked about that in the creative folks, but you could see talent and promise and people who you know are going to go far, even when they're at the very bottom rung of the ladder.
Yeah. And then, you know, you can bring up, another topic here. And, this is something I greatly believe in too, is over the years, as I began my career, there were teachers, employers who mentored me. I was very lucky. I had people who mentored me, who showed me right from wrong, who introduced me to new areas of the industry I was really not aware of. At a certain point, and that's another reason that's part of why I built Aspects of Entertainment, was also as a way of giving back. And over the years, you know, when I sort of got in, let's say, more responsible positions, I could see where the talent was. I could see where the talent wasn't. You know, you see both. And so where I could, I would always try and encourage that. Or if I didn't have something for them, I could recommend. I said, go here, you can use my knee. Or go here, or yeah, I'm giving you the referral. So it would make it that much easier for the person, because it would open the door. Because most of the time they say, well, I don't know you from Adam, but if you have a name attached, they'll either call me or they say, okay, Ron sent you. Okay, I get it. And like I said, I had those people who did it for me. And so now I can do it for other people. Not every, you know, because, they, you know, you have to be exercise some caution too. I mean, not everybody has the talent, and then everybody just wants to use you. I mean, if you're a pretty discerning person, you could see where the talent is, and it could be, like for you, Tim, it could be somebody who's a writer. You know, I'm more the visual creative people, people who are on a set. You know, if Facey has something, should be framed. You know, so it could be in any discipline of the industry. It's not just limited to one.
See, I talked about with the credit something that I'm ashamed of in the industry, but you just articulated very well something I'm very proud of about the entertainment industry, and that people don't always realize is, yes, there are cutthroat examples. I've certainly had people try to steal my job at times.
Yeah.
But there is also, I remember one time an editor helped me out a few years ago, and I said, how can I thank you? I got to take you out to dinner. And he said, nope, help out the next kid, because what I did for you, somebody did for me. And that's the way this business works, because if we help the talented people, we help the people with promise, we help each other out, everybody's going to benefit, you know? And if you work hard, and that's the thing, like, I one thing that really is, as I get older, I'm really getting a little more and more pissed off about people who are, you know, sort of expecting that phone to ring and expecting Hollywood to recognize their brilliance. No, you need to work hard. You need to show up early. You need to put in your hours. You need to put in your enthusiasm. You need to prove yourself. This is a proving ground of an industry.
Yeah.
No one's going to hand it to you.
Exactly. And, you know, somebody said to me too, well, it's not what you know, but who you know. And I will say, to some degree, there is some truth to that. All right. I've seen people get in positions who were totally clueless. However, at the end of the day, it's like the beginning of our interview, Tim. All right? If you're not contributing to the bottom line with your project, thank you very much, you know?
Damn right.
Thank you. See you. You know? Because, yeah, you still have to contribute to the bottom line. I think one of the things I would say for the most part, and like I say, it's not 100%, but I've been lucky in this respect. For the most part, I've worked with very creative people. I've worked with people who went the distance, not like gave 75%, but gave 150%.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I've been very fortunate, because when I'm in a situation where you're working with a bunch of people and you have the people who will give the 150%, and then you'll have the laggards. If, all right, and this is your responsibility, and you don't fulfill that responsibility, it drives me fucking nuts. I'm sorry. It just drives me fucking nuts. I could never, it would just irk me, you know? And it's like, I can't deal with that kind of shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I really cannot.
I totally agree with you. And, I mean, a mistake will always be better than laziness.
Exactly.
You know, to go back to that. All right, we're at exactly 1 hour. But, Ron, before I let you go, I was wondering if I could ask you this one last question. Because
sure.
You are a veritable encyclopedia, I think, of some of this stuff. And I'm a believer in this. Of,
you know, it's, I'll just interrupt you one thing.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, in school, I was not the greatest student, especially where math and science was concerned, you know. I'm thinking, you know, well, it really has no bearing in my life. And that sort of came to be true. But, you know, like, since the age of 7 or 8, going to the movies, going to the theaters, and all this information is just, like, in my head. Don't ask me how it got there. It's there.
I
can tell you, I saw this musical, or I saw this play in 1978, and it was at this theater, and the theater was half filled, whatever. Or I went to this movie, nobody else was in the theater, but I remember the theater, and I remember what day I went to see it.
Well,
I don't know why.
It spoke to your bliss. It spoke to your soul. I hate to sound all metaphysical about it, but I believe, I mean, we're trying to create those passions and experiences. But I'm a big lover of, and I'm really trying to rediscover more and more every year, of old movies and things like that, and finding some of those old great stories and what made them work and all that. And I think a lot of screenwriters should watch as many movies as they can, and I think should always be digging into the old classics.
Mm-hmm.
And not forget about them, because some of those are some of the great, great movies ever made. I mean, I could watch Casablanca every month, quite frankly. And I was wondering if you had some recommendations for some old movies that you think some of us aspiring screenwriters should check out.
Okay. There's one. There are a few. And they may not show up on a lot of lists. However, these are my favorite, and it could be whether it's in the art direction, because that's what I'm always attracted to,
mm-hmm.
being a visual person. You know, that was the thing that always stood out for me, or the way the camera was positioned. All right. I think definitely one, all right, even then, as the context of it now, is D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. Very racist movie. It was considered racist at the time it was made in 1914, I think it was.
Mm.
And it's definitely racist now. However, if a person can get past that, look at the camera angles that Griffith does. I mean, they were pioneering at the time. Okay, the same would go for Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. I mean, that is considered a lot by many of the best American film. He also did the same thing. He broke through the grounds of this, the foundation of the soundstage to get different camera angles, but it's also a very well-written script. I love Akira Kurosawa's The Seventh Samurai. And then it was like, what was it? The Magnificent Seven is based on that.
Mm-hmm.
I also love, there are two other movies. I can go on and on. There's, during the heyday of the MGM musical, and, you know, when there were MGM more stars than there are in heaven, there's this great movie called The Great Ziegfeld, based on the life of Florence Ziegfeld. Probably 10% truth. You know, everything else was fictionalized. However, from an art direction point, there's a scene, and it's so inconceivable that it would ever be on a stage, of such a Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with this turntable. And it just keeps going on and on. And you must figure there are about 300 or 400 people on this stage. And the curtain keeps going up and it's turning. Visually, it's a stunning piece. Then you have a film, 1950 or 51, all about Eve. You know, it basically was the film that resuscitated Bette Davis's career after Warner Brothers. Great acting. I mean, she's not chewing the furniture, is what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, there are actresses who, like, in fact, today is Throwback Thursday. One of my favorite, worst films ever made, but it's a favorite of mine, is Mommy Dearest with Faye Dunaway. Oh, you know, yeah. And like, she's just chewing the scenery. I mean, boy, Dunaway is just chewing the scenery on that one. No, she was, like, really good in that. But also, one of the films, I always love this film, is Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And you have to remember, this was made 78, 79, no CGI or anything like that. But it was so well done. And as many times as I see that movie, especially when that mothership comes up over the mountain, it gets me every time. And then when it comes to Doc on the top of the mountain, and you have all these great reaction shots, and you don't need a whole lot of dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all in the faces, which I will now, you know, just like say something, because I did have the opportunity to work with Sidney Lumet, the great, one of the greatest American filmmakers. And we were recording a commentary for one of his films at Spelling. Anyway, I'll make a long story short. He really gave me an insight. He said, you know, Ron, you can say more in a few looks than you can in three to five pages of dialogue. And it's true.
Yeah.
You can look at something, you get it right away, and you don't need a whole exposition to explain what's going on.
And that is I'm sorry.
Yeah, but Close Encounters really, as many times as I see it, it's still one of my favorite films from a visual standpoint, but also you can look at when that mothership lands and you look at some of the, like, the guys, the technicians, look on their faces and the lights are popping out and the music is going haywire. It's just like, whoa.
Yeah. No, it's a classic movie, and I've seen it about, I don't know, 100 times, and I hope to see it 100 more. But I did want to say, and I want to put a link to that Lumet article underneath here so people can read it. And it's such a good point for screenwriters to know that screenwriters, we're not just writing pages and pages of dialogue. We can actually write those looks, and setting up the importance of that look in a screenplay is the story engineering.
Yes,
so,
absolutely. And in fact, that's what separates the great directors from, like, the hacks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A great director could say, you don't have to say that, but if you look this way, or this is what the emotion I'm going for, and this is what needs to project, that's saying more than, like, what Ms. Sidney Lumet said to me. That's more than 3 to 5 pages of dialogue. So you can't do that on the stage. You know, that's the big difference. Mm. Because you're not there on this wide screen. So you need something. Or you have to react in a different way. There's a scene. And I don't know how many people know the movie. It's early 80s, like, or mid 80s. Meryl Streep made this film with De Niro called Falling in Love. And it's a scene you can pretty much pass over, but it shows you what a great actress, at least to me, mm-hmm. Streep is. I mean, just in the way she's on a bus and she sees De Niro and she looks at him like she should know him, but she doesn't. And so just the way her eyes cross and she just goes on. It's hard to say if people haven't seen the scene, but that's her craft as an actress, how good she is. You know what I mean? And when people ever ask me, she conveyed more in just that look of her eyes moving than if she was speaking it. If she said, well, you know, I think I should know you, but I don't. But, you know, where do I know you from?
Right.
You know, she just said it more. And I'm like, I'm sitting there in the theater. I'm saying, that's fucking A. That's like fucking A acting.
Yeah. One example, I know you may not agree with me, but I can't help but think of this. See, now we're talking old movies. We're going a little long. But I just watched it this past spring. I got it on Blu-ray, and it just holds up so well. I just was blown away on the couch just watching it going, oh, my God, this is such a cinematic masterpiece. And a movie I think that does do a lot of that with looks and conveying it is Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, yeah.
There's so much subtext underneath, you know, because he's watching her going, this is a crazy person.
Yeah.
But he can't say. And there's so much, and there's pity, and there's sadness, and there's anger, and there's so much in the looks those people give each other.
And actually, too, you know who does it more? And I think it's a very understated but really quite nuanced performance, is Von Stroheim as Max.
Mm. Mm.
You know, if you think of his reaction shot, you look at some of the way he looks askance at William Holden.
He's so heartbroken. He's just this man who just has given. I have accepted the heartbreak of my life, and that's how I'm going to live. Oh, wonderful!
But even in his scenes with Holden, the way he looks at him like you're beneath her. You know what I'm saying? You're not even in the same ballpark as her.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I don't want to go over because I know you. I do have a time.
That's okay. Well, all right. Well, we'll definitely talk some more old movies and things soon. We're setting up a lot of part twos here on the HTD Express, so maybe we'll do that. So anyway, well, listen, guys. No, for real, seriously, it is a fantastic website. Go to aspectsofentertainment.com. And one of the reasons why I like it, Ron, and that I love that you did the website is, especially for us writers, we sometimes feel like we're in a vacuum. You know, we're sitting at our computers. We get lost in our stories. We don't know if anybody's ever going to even read the thing or like it. And sometimes we go to have a website like yours where you could just go and look at some of the articles, look at some of the videos and resources and realize that, no, guys, you're actually not in a vacuum and you're not the first person to be going through some of these problems, and you're not crazy. This is the life of the creative person, and it's just really, really informative stuff on there. So go check it out and explore the website. You will be glad you did. So, Ron Greenfield, thank you so very much for taking the time out and do this. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Well, Tim, this has been a very real pleasure for me, too. I've really enjoyed it. In fact, as I said to somebody else who recently interviewed me, I mean, once you get me talking, I can't shut up. So I look forward to another opportunity. We can go in another direction.
I love it. All right, my friend. Listen, thank you very kindly. And thank you, everybody, for listening, downloading, retweeting. Please feel free to keep spreading the word. We got some interesting, cool, some more awesome film festival stuff coming up, but also some fun shows about Halloween. So hopefully that'll be to your liking. Thanks again for listening. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.